Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. My guest today is Julie Min. Julie Min is a Korean-American writer based in Shanghai. She holds an MFA in fiction from Warren Wilson, and she studied Russian and comparative literature at Harvard University. Her novel is Shanghailanders, a dazzling and ambitious debut that follows a cosmopolitan Shanghai household backward in time, beginning in 2040 and moving through our present and the recent past, exploring their secrets, their losses, and the ways a family makes and remakes itself across the years. Shanghailanders will be published in May 2024 by Spiegel and Grau in the US and Dialogue Books in the UK. Translations are forthcoming in Japanese, German, Spanish, and Norwegian. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you so much for having me, Lindsay.
I am so excited. When you reached out to me about this book, I was like, I couldn't say yes fast enough. This is exactly right up my alley, a polyvocal book that is such an interesting structure and creating the kind of magic that I haven't really encountered before. And I can't wait to talk to you about that, how you did that. But in
Thank
order
you.
for us to kick this off correctly, would you please read to us?
Yes, I would love to. So I'm going to read from a section. All of the chapters have different sort of feature different characters, different parts of this one household. And I'm going to read from the chapter that features the nanny who's lived with the Yang family for many years. And in this scene, they've gone to Lisbon for travel. And the nanny's former family has kind of relocated to Portugal. So they've kind of reached out and they're going to do a little meet up with that former family. And so here the nanny is thinking about that. Okay, here I go. The first couple of days in Lisbon, we rode a trolley tour and visited a beach. Everywhere was seafood and meat, cured hams, and no green vegetables in sight. Yoko, 5 years old and most attached to me, got so blocked up that I had to hold her hand and rub her belly for an hour while she sat on the toilet. Yumi, preferring only her mother in infancy, continued to prefer her. Yukiko, the most outgoing and fearless among them, and in that way, the most like Teya, had always been happy to venture forth on her own. And so we walked along the cobblestone streets of Lisbon, up and down hills that gave me calf cramps in the middle of the night in our pairs. Yumi and her mother, Yoko and me, and Yukiko and her father, who indulged his littlest, his last, and often wore her atop his shoulders. I thought about the end of my career, my working life, my comfortable and, you could even say, luxurious time with the Yang family. The little girls I'd raised, had I loved them? I had, especially Yoko. Had I loved them as much as I'd loved Teya? Over ice cream, the flavor of pistachio nuts, and as pale green as a budding ginkgo tree, I imagined Teya tasting for the first time this savory ice cream in her new country. It cut a sharp pain in my heart not to have been there, here. No, I'd loved Teya like none other. Dorotea, who had been so tiny I could hold her for hours on end in one arm. Maybe for a nanny, there was always only one, like a true love. Naturally, I loved my own son, now grown up and married, but it was different with him. In a way, Xiling was never truly mine, his own son. Turning one in a few months, I'd met only once, briefly, but I'd been working then too, bringing the girls and their parents to Dongbei for a ski trip during the winter holidays. The sixth arrived. The girls were less jet-lagged and cranky, and I took particular care in the afternoon to brush my hair into a nice bun and put on a dress. Over the years, Yumi's mother had given me some pieces she didn't wear, and I'd brought along one of those, a long dress for the occasion. I checked my reflection on our way out. Older, a bit thinner, but not too different from 6 years ago. Would Teya recognize me? Would she remember at all? In my rational mind, I knew she wouldn't. Babies don't remember anything before the age of 2 or 3. But still, I was nervous, was anxious to meet her expectations, if she had any. Yoko insisted on holding my hand the entire elevator ride and walk into the restaurant. I was flustered because we were already 20 minutes late to a meeting in our own hotel. But taking three children anywhere, even downstairs, took time, and Yumi's mom had taken a longer bath than anyone expected. The restaurant was only half full, and I spotted Teya and her parents right away, almost directly in the center of the large open room. Oh, Teya! She was a big girl now. I'd known it, but I'd not been prepared. Her face had grown long like her father's, her jaw protruding a bit, her wide mouth more masculine with the years. I guess I'd expected her to look like a larger version of her baby self, which was now only vaguely present. Yumi had retained her baby face with thick, long hair that everyone commented on. The possibility hadn't entered my mind that Teya wouldn't be as beautiful as Yumi, Yoko, and Yukiko. I guess because I hadn't loved them as much, and love always makes someone more beautiful. Still, she was the girl of my heart. Memories flooded my mind, feeding her in the first weeks of her life, playing with her on the lush grounds of a university near her parents' place. Her parents had aged. Her father was fatter than he'd been when she was born, and her mother looked worn out. Likely, she didn't have help raising her daughter. I knew she'd quit her job in fashion design once they moved to Portugal. I, on the other hand, was flanked by beauty. In a way, it made me feel victorious. Look at the beautiful family who hired me, and look at the beautiful girls I raised, and look at the high-quality clothes and the fancy hotel we stay at, and how long they've kept me around. As if all of this would make Taya's parents regret their decision of 6 years ago to leave China during the virus, to let me go so abruptly, so devastatingly. Hadn't the virus spread everywhere else anyway? Their leaving had been, ultimately, in vain. And yet they'd had Taya. And so, even with all this beauty on my side, I still managed to end up with the loss. I could not help myself. I let go of Yoko's hand as soon as she was seated, and I walked around to the other side of the table. I cupped my hand against Taya's face and embraced her. She didn't move, and so I ended up hugging her sideways while she looked at the Yangs one by one. Words poured out of my mouth. Taya, you've become so big. Oh, Nanny remembers you as a little baby. Do you remember Nanny? I? You used to call me I. Oh, how I've missed you. Are you well and healthy? Do you like Portugal? Taya continued to stare at the Yangs. Her mother interrupted me, pulling me out of my embrace with Taya. Auntie, I'm so sorry to say, but Taya doesn't speak Chinese. It's tough here. No one but me to speak with her. And ever since school started, it's been Portuguese nonstop.
By the way, I asked Julie to read from this section because I love it so much. I just think it's sort of encapsulates a lot of what I love about the novel, which is this sort of moving back into the past, but in a way that like you're not like time traveling. What you're do is you're what you're doing is it's like this ineffable feeling that we're not so much moving backward in time, but revisiting. And carrying the future and present with us as we travel to the past. And it's like it's this uncanny like magic that like rather than building upon itself as it would if we were moving forward, things seem to dismantle and then relayer. And it's like that section when Ai's, coming to Taya with her memories of Taya and her love for Taya that has never dimmed, but time has changed, right? Like and so things are different and so she's carrying this with her into this different time and it just it, in that moment I think we can feel time the passage of time more sharply than we can, at any other time in our lives. And so I just want to hear from you because I was so startled. The book opens in 2040 from the father Leo's point of view. And then I believe the next section we're still in 2040. Is that right? Or are we in
That's right.
2038? Okay. And so, but then you go back a few years and then back a few years and back a few years and the voices change. We get to hear from Echo, the mother. We get to hear from Yoko, one of the daughters, and Yumi and Yukiko and Ai. And you get to hear from all these different characters as we're continually pushing backward through time. And I just want to hear from you how that notion came to you? Was it always going to be
Mm.
something that you moved backward, or was it something that you realized as you wrote that you wanted to do?
It certainly was not.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a difficult decision to come to. I had several of the characters sketched out, and I knew that I wanted to write a novel that captured contemporary Shanghai. So I had a bunch of characters who at that point weren't related. Some of them were, and some of them weren't. And I'd written several of the chapters. And as I was kind of deciding how they related to one another as chapters and how this how they should be structured, kind of as I had enough to kind of form a novel, I read a ton of books that I just kind of explored other other options that authors before me had done, and I read so many different books that played with kind of these segmented pieces, you know, like a different, like a novel in stories or a novel that you know, I read like Julia Phillips' Disappearing Earth, which is, you know, it's a, in a way it's a novel in stories, but it moves chronologically over like month by month, like anagrams. I just read by Laurie Moore, which is a novel that basically rearranges the characters each in each chapter and each iteration of the kind of their lives. And I just I just read a ton, and I thought about what the best way to put the book together was. In the end, I ended up kind of changing a lot of the characters to fold them into this story. So, like, you know, Echo in Lane Life, which is a story that comes towards the end of the novel. So it's a it's quite so it comes in the past, right? It comes quite early in the past and chronologically. And so you could say it's quite like pivotal, but actually that character was a white woman having an affair with a Chinese man.
Wow. Oh my
And her
gosh.
entire backstory was, you know, she had grown up in like a post-Soviet country, and there was this whole backstory that I loved. And I, you know, it just, I remember my thesis advisor at my MFA program was like, I was talking to her about the possibility of changing that character to become Echo, because I had some of the future iterations of her. And she was like, well, why not? You know, just do
Right.
it. Just try it. And
Yes.
I was like, but it's I love the backstory. It had this like very kind of like post-Soviet kind of like childhood. And I was really attached to it. And she was like, well, you can always keep it. Nothing, it's not like you're throwing it away. It's not like
Right.
it's disappearing. It's maybe you can publish it another day as like a kind of you know, like alternate edition or something. But and I tried it, and it worked really well. And I realized, okay, so that's I can do that, and it tightens the story. I mean, it tightens the family, and I don't have to create these kind of like random relations for these tertiary characters. And the and also seeing the city of Shanghai through a family, through kind of one household, you know, also helped kind of thematically and in other ways too.
So for you, this whole thing started with place.
Yes, that's right.
And you
Definitely.
just wanted to give, and that makes so much sense to me because Shanghai is going to be something different to so many different people, right? Like it's going to be different to Echo, who is Japanese and French, you know, and it's going to be different to Leo, who is a native Shanghailander, and it makes so much sense that that we would get a sense of Shanghai from all these different perspectives.
That's right. Shanghai is this, and I've lived here for about 10 years. I'm Korean American. The city is enormous. It's of a scale that's like unimaginable. It's 25 million people living here.
Oh my
And
God.
even, size-wise, it's this enormous city with like these like satellite cities. And it's like an ancient city as well. It's been around forever and part of this ancient country, and it's got so many different like sections, even visually, that represent so many different that could represent so many different parts of its history. You've got like the semi-colonial, European style streets with cobblestones and like kind of leaf like tree leafy tree lined pedestrian walkways, and
The
then you've
period
also
trees.
got the French plane trees, and then you've got like your Blade Runner-esque high rise, lights, and that's all part of the experience of this city. Just this kind of really this incredible sense of like futurism and like being on the cutting edge, being huge, taking big steps, and then also the past, which is ever present and in many ways traumatic, in many ways beautiful, in many ways romanticized. You've also got that like Paris of the East, flapper girls and jazz men. It's really a city of contradictions, and the people who live here, you've got foreigners and locals, intense socioeconomic stratification. So the possibilities when you want to like write a book about contemporary Shanghai, it's really too huge to kind of to grasp. And so actually focusing in on one household and one family, and then also, of course, the people who work for them, was kind of my strategy in the end.
I really love that because that's always my impulse is like I want to show so much, and I want to, and the way that I'm going to do it is by giving you these little bite size, and yours, the chapters in Shanghailanders are not bite size, but giving you like glimpses of these people's lives at certain points, because it sort of just creates this notion of like I'm getting to see this little slice. And then I'm moving to this other time and this other character, but it makes me feel like that thing that I was just in is still going, or like it's not over. It makes me feel like, I don't know, it's magic. It just feels like magic, the way that you're able to show us so much of Shanghai and so much of this family and the people that work for the family by doing it in this, novel and stories. It's not a novel and stories, but is, like what you were saying earlier, like just this polyvocal checking in, with these characters over the years. And I think that's like, I don't know why I'm so attracted to that. I love novels like that. I know that like in the past people have on this podcast have said like, oh, my agent told me don't write a novel and stories, or we can't sell this kind of book. But I absolutely love it. And I think it's because it gives me this feeling that your novel has given me, which is like a like I'm a step closer to life than I would be in a more traditionally structured novel, like it's,
Oh, interesting.
I don't know. Do you feel the same way when you're reading novels like this?
I mean, I definitely have always loved novels like this, or works like this. I remember, like in college, reading Winesburg, Ohio,
Oh,
and
so good.
and reading. I mean, I first read like James Joyce's The Dead. And then I later came to the whole collection Dubliners, and just really getting a sense of a place, getting a sense of, like, as you said, life. Kind of, yeah, it's I've always been interested in this, and of course, I think every writer is interested in place. But yeah, I definitely wanted to create a bigger picture, and also to highlight kind of the, I guess, through the structure of the novel, how, I suppose, how fractured the city is too, like there's the family, the Yang family, who are so incredibly wealthy. They're like crazy rich Asians level. And then they have this whole like domestic staff working underneath them. And those staff, like the Ayi, she has her own inner life. She has her own past. She has her heartaches and her loves and her own husband and her, she has all of that. But how much do the Yang family pay attention to that, or know, are aware of that? How much do they think of her after she leaves their employ? And so, just kind of making sure that she's there, but also highlighting the ways in which people are sometimes invisible, or the relationships between people within a household can be so heartbreakingly unfair. And not just between employer and employee, but also between husband and wife and sister and sister. They've all got their issues.
I mean, I was so struck by the Yumi Yoko relationship. Their sisters, Yumi is the older sister and Yoko's the middle sister. And just like the strain of that kind of sibling that Yumi is, like just very harsh
Yeah,
and
vicious.
we and vicious, yeah. And like I could really see that so clearly and see how it was sort of like shaping so many things. But in the same way, Yoko loves Yumi, like that's her big sister. And that is really hard to write. And you did it, like you showed the complication of that kind of relationship. Of just like absolute familial love and also just kind of like fear of this person.
And I like, in the future, as they grow older, the question for you, for Yoko, will be, how can I escape, right? Or should I escape? Or what, and I think that's a question that runs through the whole book, of, how do we grapple with our pasts? How do we how do they inform our present? And yeah, I remember someone asked me the other day, like, who was the hardest sister to write of the
Ooh,
three?
that's such a great
And
question.
yeah, and I mean, the easiest was Kiko, because Kiko is like, she's just she like puts it all out there,
Yeah, she does.
and she's got so much sass, and she's like, she's the youngest, and she's a performer, and she's so bright and charming. And then yeah, and then Yoko was, not too difficult. But then Yumi, I struggled with Yumi a little bit, and I also struggled with the question of how much to, I guess, kind of like forgive her, like how much sympathy the reader should feel with her, or for her. How much of a backstory should she get? Because I think in life, I think in life, some people are mean, and I think that it's almost, sometimes it's important to show human, it's always important to show humanity and complexity, but sometimes with even humanity and complexity, people Armin, you know, and make those choices to be a certain kind of way. And so, you know, I think ultimately many of the people in this family and in this story are good people. But not everyone is like totally good, you know?
Absolutely. And I
I mean,
think,
you know.
of course,
You
I
write
mean,
crime fiction.
yeah, you've read Hot Springs Drive, I know. But
Yeah,
I think
and
one of the things I admire
so
so
good.
much
So good, yeah.
about the, like, you know, like there's so take for example, like the first section, the very first opening section is mainly Leo's perspective, but we also get is it Shayna? Or is
Yep.
it Shauna?
Shauna.
Shauna, she is working on the train, and we get her perspective briefly. And it turns out she actually knows Leo. He doesn't recognize her, but back before her husband died and she was kind of living a fancier life, she had gone to a dinner party.
Right.
Was it at the Yang's house, or they happened to be at the same dinner party?
Yeah, they were at the same dinner party. It was
And
hosted by Shanna and her husband,
oh, that's
and she
right.
was like
Okay.
working at the at she was cooking, but yeah.
Yes, and so she witnesses this fight between Echo and Leo, and she just it made her kind of wonder about them, and you know, then she never really saw them again until now, and you know, so she's and so you're kind of like, oh, interesting. Okay. What was that about? And it was years ago, right? And so and
Right.
then I thought, okay, so I'm sure at some point in this novel we're going to get that scene and we're going to find out what the fight was about, but we never do. And you do that repeatedly. You give us these little glimpses of like the girls noticing their parents fighting, or you know, like noticing tension, but we don't ever we in the you know, look, when we get to the past, we never get those scenes. You do such an amazing job of giving us just enough. And then when we get to Yumi's section, I do feel absolutely sympathetic toward her because
Yeah.
she is the oldest child living in a
Yes.
home with a ton of tension and
That's
fighting.
right.
And
Yes.
kids don't have the ability to say, "Hey, things are messed up around here. Can we talk about it?" Right? Like they express that in the ways that they know how to express it. And for Yumi, it is through like acts of rage or
Right.
trying to leave, or you know, later like shoplifting, you know, like they're those feelings have to get out somehow, and they get out the way they get out with.
Right.
And so to me, you were very you laid enough groundwork for us to see, like, yes, Yumi has her own personality, and like maybe that's like a, you know, a harsher personality, but at the same time
Right.
she's also like dealing with a bunch of stuff that no one's
Yeah.
sitting her down and saying, "Hey, I'm sorry that you're witnessing these things," right?
Yeah, and you see, I think, you know, there's a scene where she's at Harvard and she's like she's going through a tough situation and she's maybe like manipulating some boy, but I think, yeah, I wanted to show that she's also in a way deeply insecure on many levels, and also like deeply in need of like love.
Yeah, and I mean, you know,
So
if like you've had these feelings before and they didn't lead anywhere useful for you, or like you have
yeah.
too many feelings and no one's like helping you with them, or they get in the way of you like just surviving day to day, you're going to start trying not to have those feelings, you know? And so like
Right.
you might treat a boy like as a useful tool, right? Or you know,
Yeah.
you might not notice like, oh, my sister doesn't really confide in me anymore, or she doesn't trust me. You know, like you're just like surviving the way that your childhood self knew how to survive. And then, you know, I don't know. I was very moved by her, even as she's very prickly and
Yes, she's prickly. She's
yes.
prickly.
Yeah. And I actually think Yoko comes to a good place about her. I mean, just as far as I can tell in
Right.
Yoko's earlier section. Earlier in the novel, I mean, it seems like she kind of like she doesn't hate Yumi, you know? She just kind of like she doesn't really trust Yumi, but also she doesn't hate her, right? Like, I don't know. I feel like that's kind of okay for them to be at in their early 20s.
Right. Yeah, just figuring out how to start to be mature about it. Yeah. Exploring different ways.
Yeah, and like it's just amazing because in the beginning, the first time you see Echo, she's thinking about how she might meet up with her college sweetheart.
Right.
And then toward the end of the novel, you get a section with Echo when she's first married to Leo. And this is the section that you were talking about earlier that was originally a white woman having an affair with a Chinese man.
Yeah.
And
Right.
it turns out it's Echo having an affair, right? And
Yes.
you go, oh my God, I had no idea, you know, like, and I think she does refer to it in like earlier in the novel and in her first section. Doesn't she refer to like an affair that she had? Like at some point she's like, just when I was younger, but I regretted it. I don't remember. I can't remember, but it's like, oh
Yeah.
wow, like this has been going on for a long time. Like there hasn't been like open communication for a while, right?
Yeah, I think definitely I think my novel is like a PSA for good communication, the importance of communication in a marriage.
Yeah, try it out. Why don't you try it out? So you said you mentioned earlier you moved to Shanghai 10 years ago.
That's right.
At what point did it feel like home to you?
Yeah, I think it so I've lived like a bunch of lives in Shanghai because I had just gotten married and moved here with my husband, and so we were initially kind of like young and exploring the city and having a lot of fun. And then later we had our kids, and then now our kids are, still young but in school. And so and we've lived in various places in the city. And so yeah, over the past 10 years, it's really felt like I've lived like type different lives and had like different sets of friends. My like artsy friends, my like mom friends, and but I think probably it started to feel like home once I had children of my own. And I think when you have children of your own, you start to think about home in a different way too, obviously, because you have to think about ways in which you want to create a home. And you have to actually make active decisions about what traditions you want to follow, what holidays you want to celebrate, what languages you want to speak. You have to shape your family. And you're also like shaping the memories of these young people,
Oh my God,
right?
yes. Yep. Yeah.
And like, who's gonna do it? I mean, in a lot of families, but mom, like,
Right, I know.
so I think that once we had our children a few years ago, they're like 5 and 2 now. I think, yeah, that just probably was one of the moments that made me feel like, okay, we're here. This is our life. We are a family unit.
Oh.
As opposed to like two young people,
Yep.
working and living and exploring and enjoying. Because, at that point, almost any city is, not to say interchangeable, but if you are someone who can work in many places, then you have choice, and it's really about where you want to live. Yeah, for whatever reasons.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's just like you're saying, you start to see home through your children's eyes. Right, like, and
Right.
you start to wonder what their sense of home feels like, you know, like what exactly, like you're saying, like what am I creating, what will they remember,
Right.
because that is such a formative thing when you think of home, what it feels like to be home. It's, you know, it's probably from your childhood, from your deep, deep childhood. And you
Right.
know, it's the same with me. Like we moved to Chicago almost 20 years ago, and it was never really home until like the kids came along, and it was like,
Right.
oh, now the home is kind of about them and kind of what they're experiencing.
Yeah, and I think, to that point, I don't think I could have written this novel without that kind of, like, I guess, like revolution in my own thinking and relationship to this city, and also kind of the experience of understanding the intensity of motherhood, you know, and like how it's, I mean, I don't think I could have written this book without, and I'm a young mother, you know, I have young children, but still, you know, it's different.
So different.
It's
It is.
different, yeah.
It's well, I guess I'm just curious about, you know, because you went to Harvard, you are Korean American, you studied Russian literature, but you chose Shanghai as the place for
Oh,
the,
yes.
you know, for the novel that you were writing. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I moved to Shanghai for love. So
Yeah.
my husband is Shanghainese. We met and we moved here together. Why Shanghai as opposed to, I don't know, other places? I mean, it's the place that I've lived, and it's, I think the people that I met here have been so just inspiring and interesting. This is not the first novel I've attempted to write. I actually before this I was writing like a historical fiction novel set in Shanghai,
Ooh.
and yeah, so I did a ton of, so when I first came to Shanghai, and I didn't know it very well, I was very intrigued with the kind of like glamour of the 1930s, and I was like seduced by that romanticized history, which is not to say that it doesn't exist and it's not romantic, it's just, you know, it was accessible to me as a reader of like Western literature, of which there's a lot of, you know, like 1930s noir or like World War II narratives, and for me that, you know, that was really exciting. I used to be like a jazz singer, so I love jazz, and
You did?
yeah.
Amazing.
So anyway, I was crazy about that period. I did a ton of research into the history of Shanghai, and I wrote this kind of sweeping historical novel that ultimately like didn't ever get finished. But at the end of that process of like working on like a revision of that book, I was so exhausted, and I felt like I was also dipping into cliches and kind of narratives that were already existing, and I was also having a hard time playing with those tropes. You know, it's not to say that one can't use tropes, but I was having a hard time figuring out my place within that genre, I guess. And I started Shanghailanders almost as like a reprieve. You know, I want to write something contemporary. I want to write about, at that point, I lived in Shanghai for many years, and I don't know, like 5 years at that point. And I knew it so much better. I had met so many people across the spectrum, and you know, I have in-laws who are Shanghainese, and so I just knew a lot more about the city and the people who live here today. And I thought, you know, there aren't actually that many narratives about contemporary Shanghai. And you know, I really don't, I'm not actually that interested in writing about, you know, like a kind of foreign concession story, or like a kind of, you know, I just wanted to write a story that felt more, I guess more true to my experience of the city. And without any history, without like, you know, I'd done a lot of research, but without having to, you know, write a historical novel, really. So that's like part of the reason why Shanghailanders act, you know, got started.
Yeah, I think like when I think about what it must feel like to write historical fiction, it's almost like every choice you make has to be checked through the lens
Yes.
of could this actually happen at the
That's
time?
right.
And if it could, what did it look like? And
That's right.
And then, oh, okay, well, sure, this could happen, but why are they holding this thing when they wouldn't have had that until
That's
3 years
right.
later? And, you know, like,
Right.
oh God, I feel like that could be so crippling in some ways.
It's just a lot of work, you know? It's like, yeah, it just magnifies the amount of work. And I'm not like afraid of work. It's just that that project wasn't like working. It wasn't
Yeah, it's
good.
funny how like you can be working on something and then this other thing starts to call to you, and it's almost like the
Right.
thing that you were doing, and let's not say that this novel won't ever see the light of day, because I have faith that it will. But like this other, you know, like it's almost like the act of working on this historical fiction novel made you more like open to the thing that you needed to write in that moment, right? Like you were able to pivot because you had done enough of the other thing to where you could sort of like immerse yourself into this more modern world of Shanghai.
Yeah, and I think this book is a little bit is like, you know, it's more emotionally vulnerable than the characters who were in my like historical fiction, who were kind of, it was very plotty. And I think I wasn't really accessing them, the characters as much, as deeply. But you know, with these characters, I really tried to write richly developed characters who have their very, very like complicated histories, personal histories. And I also think that, you know, not just living in Shanghai and being exhausted with the historical fiction novel, but I think also becoming a mother, I think it created a fearlessness within me, Lindsay. And I don't know if you felt this way too. Not to say that you have to have, because I think your writing has always been fearless, but I think that probably before I was a little bit afraid of touching the kind of dirty stuff, you know, like the sex and the emotional messiness and the, you know, like the depressing stuff or whatever, you know, like I think I was afraid of a little bit afraid of going there, going and just like
Digging
playing in
in.
it. And actually, I think like becoming a mom, I was like, man, like if my daughter wanted to write something, or not, I didn't actively think this, but you know, just like loving my children so much and accepting them for who they are and just being like, you know, I would accept anything that my, you know, like if my daughter wanted to become like a performance artist who did crazy stuff with her body and like just like really just went out there, I would be proud of her, you know? And I realized that like that's how I needed to treat myself. I needed to like love myself as a writer in the way that a mother loves a child, kind of.
That's incredible. That is absolutely incredible. I've never heard it put that way before, but it makes so much sense that you would see the kind of love and acceptance that we all deserve, right?
That's
Like,
right.
and to give that to yourself is so beautiful because your kids also love that about you, right? Like one day they'll read
Yeah.
your novels, maybe. And they'll see what a deep soul that you have, and like and the deep understanding that you have of people's inner lives, and also that you had this part of yourself that like was wholly your own, you know? Like I really think it's important for kids to see that side of their parents. Is there's a part of me that is mine, right?
That's right. Yeah.
I love the notion that it made you fearless. That is just beautiful.
Yeah. And so, you know, in this book, there's like a little bit of sex, and there's like some, you know, I just didn't hold back. You know, I just, if I wanted to go there, I went there. And there were even chapters that like people were like, whoa, Julie, this cannot see the light of day.
What? We need those chapters. Come on.
Deleted, redacted.
Oh.
I went even further, Lindsay.
That is okay. We need Shanghailanders part two, or like we need like the addendum or whatever it is. We need the diaries. What?
Yeah, and I remember like when I was querying agents, I with this book and like the former version of it, some agents were even like, this is a little bit too gross for me.
Gosh.
But yeah, I just
I have to say, like, when I encounter that in a book, what feels to me like something that goes really far, something that I haven't really encountered before. Like, I remember in Jasmine Chan's School for Good Mothers, I think there's a scene with anal sex, and it like I just wasn't expecting it to go there, and I just remember thinking like, thank you. You know,
Yeah,
like
she
people
went
should
there.
write about these things. People, you know, like
It's a part
in
of life.
serious literary novels, those
It
kinds of
happens
things.
in
Yes,
life.
it happens in life, okay? And it's necessary for this narrative. And there's another, I think there's a, in one of Sue Miller's books, I think it's also anal sex. Maybe it's just anal sex fetish with me, but like, it just like, oh my God, you know, like, thank you for going there. Thank you. So, Julie, thank you for going there and keep
Yeah,
going
well,
there.
yeah. I mean, I went to some places that nobody wanted me to go to, and I realized in the end, okay, I don't need to go there. But yeah, no, I did feel like this writing this book was a way in which I kind of, I guess, like came into my own, came into a kind of confidence that I hadn't had before. And yeah.
That is the coolest. I love that.
Yeah.
How does it feel that you're about to have your debut come out?
It feels very, I mean, it feels amazing. It feels really exciting. It feels very far away because, I'm in Shanghai and I'll be in the US and the UK for book tours, but I have like a lot of things kind of before that, like trips with like family vacation and stuff. So, yeah, it feels exciting. It just doesn't feel real, it doesn't feel real on many levels, like because it's because I'm not in New York anymore, and because like I'm a mom and I have like a sick kid who like cries every hour. So it's like it feels like incredible, and it's a dream come true. It's the life that I've always wanted. I've always wanted to be a writer, and actually, like part of the inspiration for the, like, I don't know, to bring it, I don't need to always bring it back to the book, but part of the inspiration for the Echo character was that I was pregnant with my first child, and I met someone who was also pregnant and who told me essentially that, like her job was just to get pregnant, and she was just going to be a mom for a while. And even though I knew that's a thing that people do, that women do, is that they get pregnant, they have children, and they are just moms for a while, and they don't have ambitions beyond that, because that's I mean, that's enough, right? We know that it's enough. It's a lot already.
It
But
is.
actually, even though I knew that theoretically, I had never met someone who said that to me so frankly. And for me, that was so inconceivable, because for my whole life, I've always yearned for so much. Like, I've yearned for a creative life, and I've like yearned for, like artistic expression and whatever. And so, that was like a moment when I really liked this person. She was like deep and interesting and complex, and like a full person, and I think that was part of that kind of curiosity into that experience was part of where Echo was born. But
In some ways I'm like, okay, because I'm the same as you. I've been yearning and yearning since I was a child, like it's always with me. Even like I'm just always wondering when I can get back to the page, back to the page, like what I'm working on, what I want to do and my hopes and all that. And I assume that everyone feels that way, right? Like they're all like, maybe it's not an art, like maybe they're not pursuing some sort of art, but they're pursuing something, right? They're yearning for something. But, and so like I hear that and I think, oh, does she, like, is she okay? But I also really admire it because I remember, I can't remember who said this or I read it somewhere. Someone said the key to success, for being a mother is to do one thing at a time. And because I find myself multitasking constantly, like constantly. I'm with the kids at the same time that I'm getting some work done and I'm thinking about whatever I'm working on and
Maybe
like
listening to an audiobook on one ear.
totally. Yes, exactly. And like planning and plotting and emailing and like talking, like listening to them and playing and I end up doing everything like 20% well. And so to me that seems like, in one way that seems like I'd be letting go of something really valid and like important to who I am, at the same time that I think, if only I could trust that I could let go of it for a second and just be fully present and then pick it back up later when I'm able to be fully present for it. But it feels too dicey. It feels too terrifying. It feels like I'd be dulling something, irreparably.
I mean, it's just hard,
It's just
one.
hard, yes.
And it's a cultural difference too, because like in Shanghai Landers, the family, they have a staff, they have a village, and a lot of times in the US, it's mom juggling all those balls. So it's a cultural difference too, and there's a way in which motherhood in China, it's the only place I've experienced motherhood, is a lot more forgiving in some ways than in the US, at least, from what I've noticed from other friends who are still there. There's this, even with like the whole postpartum experience, like in China, there's a whole, like month that you can't do anything. So if you take it, like if you're really strict about it, you can't like even take a
Oh my
bath.
gosh,
But
wow.
most people don't do that. They just basically like rest for a month and let everyone do everything, and then everyone is like, oh yes, the mom, like take care of the mom. And then of course, like for many historical, cultural reasons, like grandparents take care of the kids a lot. So, it's been so fascinating living here in a foreign country and experiencing motherhood in a way that was, I grew up in the US. My mom is Korean American, but she was also raised in the US. And so I had like an American childhood, and my mom did everything, for me and my sister. She did everything. And so, just to see like culturally what's accepted here and how it's so different, it's just fascinating. And like the family, like in my book, they're kind of special in the fact that they have a lot of privilege. But I do think, and I hope that readers can also take a glimpse of, some aspects of life here that might surprise them or kind of be interesting,
Absolutely.
as it was to me.
Yeah, I mean, Echo didn't grow up in privilege, right? So she's very privileged now in the now of the book, but she wasn't very privileged. You know, it was her and her mom, right?
Right.
And we get
And Leo
Ivy and
too. Yeah.
Leo too. Yes, you're right. And yeah, so I, you know, I think it's all there. And it's so interesting what you said about the cultural aspect of it, because yeah, like in I had two C-sections and they were basically like, here's your baby, you can't hold your baby. You know,
Yeah.
like
Bye.
yeah, no going up the stairs and no holding your other kid and see ya, and your husband has to
Yeah.
go back to work. And
Right.
you know,
And
and you
then
kind
in like
of
a month, you have to go back to work,
right, exactly. My
you know,
sister went
for
back,
most months.
my sister went back at 6 weeks because she owned her own
Right.
business and she didn't have, you know, she didn't have maternity leave, and 6 weeks
Yeah.
was her not getting paid for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And so it convinces you, like, well, this is how it's done, and if it's hard, that's your fault.
Right.
So I, yeah, I think you're right about that.
Yeah, there's so many structures in place that can make it harder than it has to be, but yeah.
Absolutely. Before I let you go, would you please tell us what the Shanghai lit scene is like?
Shanghai lit scene. Yeah, it's vibrant, and there's when I first came here, of course, I had more access to like the international literary scene. There are a lot of foreigners here in Shanghai. It's like this incredibly diverse place that attracts expats. Also like, heads of multinationals who are here to run those companies and their families. But also like English teachers and artists. And so, when I first moved here, I was very much like involved in kind of the vibrancy of that art scene. And yeah, now I could say I'm like out and about less, mostly because I'm a mom and I have a 2-year-old. But Shanghai is this really like spectacular city that's also like so unique within China. It's like its own culture, its own kind of very particular type of being Chinese and Chinese experience. For example, in Shanghai, and this is mostly like the older generation because the younger generation is different, but like culturally, like a lot of times Shanghainese men will like do the housework, do the cooking. And so it's
What?
this, yeah. Like when my husband came to like Christmas, I come from like a Korean family, a Korean immigrant family. So my grandfather was like, he's like stuck in like the 60s, and culturally, and all the men are like in like eating snacks, and all the women are like coming out from the kitchen to bring them snacks, and they're
Oh
like
my
watching football.
gosh.
And my husband was like, "What's going on here?" She was like shocked because in Shanghai, it's the opposite. Like the men are in the kitchen, cooking up a storm, and the women are outside chatting. And
What?
so like this is just like Shanghai culture, and it's yeah, it's so fascinating, like just how different areas in China have their own unique cultures. You have this like kind of you have this sort of like idea, this kind of like mythology of like the Shanghainese gentleman, like this very like genteel, like polite, catering, or not like, but just gentlemanly type of person who's like a little bit kind of foreign influenced and educated and maybe a little bit snobby. Yeah, so there are all these elements of Shanghai, and I put some of those things into the book, like when they're hiring the nanny, they're like, "Oh, look, Shanghainese people don't like people from this region or whatever."
That's right. Oh my God.
Yeah, and I mean, not to say I'm not trying to like make those statements, of course, but
No.
people, there is this image of like Shanghai and Shanghainese as the kind of like, on one hand, it is like the most cosmopolitan, the richest, the financial hub, like the tallest in terms of high rise, building. It's like it's got these superlatives, this like superlative aspect to it. And also, and I think in part because of that, people have this, there is this sense of like Shanghai as its own culture, as its own, there's like a sense of Shanghai fashion style and kind of being a certain way. And so, yeah, I think it, for me, I wanted to also incorporate some of those elements of Shanghai into the book as well. Yeah.
Well, you
But
did a great
yeah.
job.
Thank you.
I absolutely love this book. I'm so glad that I was able to read it and that we were able to have you on. I am so excited for this book to come out. I think it's going to make a big splash.
Thank you, Lindsay. I absolutely love your writing. And
Oh, thank you.
I mean, we were talking about it earlier, but I think about Hot Springs Drive every day. I think about the
Oh.
characters. I think about myself as a reader and my expectations for true crime and romance. You did such an amazing job, like writing such an interesting book that messes with you.
I love that. That has to be the blurb on the next on the paperback. That messes with you. Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Shanghailanders messes with you. Okay, like it really does. That's the kind of magic I'm talking about. So everyone go get it as soon as it comes out. What day, do you know what day in May it comes out in the US?
It's on May 7th in the
May
US.
7th. Okay. And then in the UK,
May 9th.
May 9th. Okay. Have fun. Enjoy this bubble before the, before the
The
book
bubble
comes in.
bursts.
I was gonna say before the bubble bursts, but that's not what I mean. What I mean
It's
is
okay.
you're
It's
like in this like wonderful like anticipatory time, and then it's going to be like kaboom. So
okay.
in a great way,
Yeah.
in a good
No,
way.
I'm yeah, all expectations are being kept low.
Okay.